In this week's episode, Jenny Stone and Katie Singer discuss the 2024-25 contract updates and GMS contract variations.
Accountancy on Prescription by RBP, one of the leading firms of medical specialist accountants. We know what you find tough, but don't you worry, as we know our stuff.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Accountancy on Prescription. I'm Jenny Stone, one of the partners at RBP, and I'm joined by my lovely partner, Katie Singer. Hi, Katie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Jenny. How are you?
I'm all right. Although we're both suffering with the good old common cold, aren't we? So yeah. Apologies if we all sound a bit nasally. This week's episode, we're going to talk about the recent announcements to the GP contract for 24-25. Katie, before we get sort of stuck into talk about the headlines, what I just thought I would remind, well, we don't need reminding, but where we're at with the GP contract. So in 1920, there was an agreed five-year deal. We had the introduction of PCNs and the core funding increases were all agreed back in kind of 1920. And obviously, since then, we've had COVID, massive increase in demand and pressure on general practice. We've had cost of living inflation sitting at 10%. And of course, what we know is core funding for practices hasn't really increased to deal with any of these issues. And unfortunately, what we've seen is, as expected, practice profits were down for 22-23. We're expecting the same for 23-24. So Katie, let's pick out some of the positives from the announcements. What did you sort of pick out as a positive from the headlines?
Yeah, I said to Jen earlier when we were discussing this podcast that we need to start on some positives, because every time we do any kind of chatty reviews of announcements in general practice, we always seem to pull out the negatives and that's all we seem to talk about. But what I got when I read the letter, which we'll put in the show notes of the podcast so you can click on so you can see what we're referring to in case you're not au fait with what we're talking about. The big thing I took and the main positive was that there has been a real understanding that there have been some significant cash flow issues at the practices in the last, I would say, 18 to 24 months. We've discussed this before. COVID was a real band-aid. There was lots of extra support, lots of extra funding, lots of fixed and caps, you know, monies, QOF was fixed, enhanced services were fixed. It really distorted the way that practices were paid. COVID ended, surplus funding stopped, and cash flow has plummeted. And this isn't just one or two practices. Jen, what would you say? 80 to 90%.
Yeah, I've had lots of conversations with practices where we've talked about, you know, we need to increase working capital, we need to leave more in. I've actually had two practices really struggling that have actually had loans from ICB because of cash flow. So yeah, cash flow has been a massive problem.
So one of the key things they've mentioned in the letter is to support cash flow, the QOF payment. So historically, your QOF has always been paid in monthly aspiration payments of 70%. That will increase up to 80%, and they're actually protecting, what did you say, was 32, 36 of the indicators?
Absolutely. So they're protecting 32 of the indicators. So that does mean, well, that seems to imply that the practices aren't going to have to do the work for those indicators, but will earn the income, just like they did in COVID. Although I was talking to a practice last week and they said, well, it doesn't actually say what year it'll be protected on, you know, is it the last year? But it does say that 32 indicators will be protected.
Yeah. And this is positive. I mean, percentage wise, going from 70% to 80%, if you think about how much you get as your aspiration payment, we're not talking about huge, huge amounts. But again, it's still a positive. You'll still get the achievement payment, hopefully in June following the year end, once you've completed your QOF for the year. But this will just support you going forward that you're going to be getting slightly more upfront. The letter also mentions that there will be more funding going into PCNs, and PCNs are heavily mentioned in the letter and they'll come up as our second point, but a lot more money is going to be flowing into PCNs more upfront, and therefore it allows the money to come back to your practices quicker. Because I know, Jen, you've probably had practices, especially with the ARS funding, there's been some real delays. And so, of course, if you're a practice and you're sitting there and you've got, I don't know, one, two, three, four members of of the ARS team on your payroll, but you're waiting for months to receive the reimbursement back from the PCN, that's going to hit your cash flow. Yeah. So it's been a real balancing act for the last couple of years.
And I've certainly had lots of practices that say that money coming from the PCNs has been, you know, has been a lot slower. And so that has massively impacted on cash flow. So hopefully, and actually then when you talk to the PCNs are saying, but actually we put our claims in and they get delayed. So hopefully if PCNs are getting more money up front, then that can be passed to practices and hopefully will help practices with cash flow.
Yeah, and what the letter says is that via the PCNs, the capacity and access and IIF monies will be paid 70% upfront, and the clinical directors will have the ability, if they're able to, I mean, it doesn't quite lay out exactly what they have to do. It does say in the top of the letter that more information will be coming in the next few weeks. But if clinical directors can provide the relevant data sooner than the end of the financial year, they will be able to receive the remaining 30%. So there is definitely a potential for PCNs going forward that the PCNs will be able to get more money up front, which means it can just, again, be passed straight back to practices. So that was a definite positive that I took from it. Even just the recognition that cash flow is an issue was positive for me.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Katie. Absolutely. Now, the letter talked a lot about PCN. So I know we've got to the end of the five-year introduction with PCNs. And I did have some clients going, oh, I'm hoping they're going to do away with PCNs and put all the money into the global sum. And I know we always have our work cut out dealing with the accounts with PCNs and lead practices, but they haven't been abolished. And we kind of knew too much is invested in PCNs for them just to be abolished after the 5 years. But Katie, do you want to go through what the changes were for PCNs?
Yeah. So like you say, there's a real split of opinions on PCNs. And as we know from dealing with so many and just talking to so many of you on a day-to-day basis, some PCNs are running so wonderfully and efficiently, and practices are so happy to be within one. Others, not so much so. And there's issues. And of course, we can't get too political on the podcast, but many PCNs operate completely differently. But the reason why they won't be abolished, and I can't imagine they now ever will, is the ARS. You know, the ARS is such a huge, huge, huge element of the PCNs. And there are, I don't know, tens of thousands of individuals employed up and down the country, there would not be a capacity where these individuals are just going to be made redundant or unable to continue in their job role. So they're here to stay for the foreseeable, unless they develop into something else further down the line. Again, that's all being laid out, we assume. But for now, the ARS are here to stay. And one of the things that came out of this letter is that there needed to be more flexibility with the ARS roles. They were quite rigid, and they're just allowing there to be more ARS staff to be employed by PCNs, and also removing certain caps. So again, with pay increases and the amount of staff that PCNs require, these caps have been waived again. These are just the headlines. We haven't got the more detailed information yet. That's coming in the next few weeks. But this is what we're understanding, that there will be a greater flexibility with our staff. And hopefully some of that funding coming in, as I mentioned just before, sooner, so that it can be passed back to the practices that are employing, if possible.
And I know that they're now going to allow sort of enhanced nurses to be included in the ARS scheme. So that's good. Although I know practices always say to me, they struggle to recruit nursing. Although that is still capped. My understanding is that that's capped at one per PCN.
Yeah.
Two if your list size is over 100,000.
Exactly.
So again, the roles have been expanded.
And the other element sort of that was hinted about with the PCNs is that it's been quite complex over the last 5 years to try and navigate the claims. Therefore, there's been an emphasis this year that they're going to streamline the DES requirements. And they're doing that basically in three ways. So the first is that they're going to replace all the PCN services with effectively one overarching DES other than the enhanced access service. So the enhanced access service will remain, and the rest will just be a generic overarching PCN DES to allow for it to be much more straightforward. Although, you know, thinking from an accountancy perspective, it just means there's going to be large lump sums of money coming in. you may not necessarily have a breakdown of what element this is for. You would hope that there's some back office admin done to allow you to know where you've achieved and where you haven't. But as we know from general practice, often these are just lump sums that are given.
Yes.
The second is that the CD role is also going to be updated and simplified. And as I mentioned earlier, the CD will be able to provide data to the ICB sooner so that they're able to get more money in for the PCN. So there'll be better communication channels, I gathered from the letter, which is great. And then finally, the CD role and the leadership funding is going to be combined so that there is going to be better distribution of the funds by the CD within the local community, because that's the whole point of the PCN. You know, what works in one area may not necessarily work for another population. And so it just gives more onus on the CD to be able to provide for their specific PCN, which again is a positive, I hope.
Yes, yes. No, definitely.
And then really the only other thing that came out of the PCNs is to do with the IIF. There were a huge number of indicators in 21-22. There were 36. This was brought down in 23-24. But going forward into 24-25, there's actually only going to be two indicators for health checks and fit testing in cancer referrals. So it should be far more streamlined, meaning so many of you told us that you really struggled to get your IIF monies in. And this should, again, streamline the process, bringing that money in quicker. All of the other indicators pass back within the generic DES that's going to be part of the PCN.
No, thank you, Katie. And I think, I don't know about what you see. I mean, I've seen a real difference in how the PCN funding comes through to practices. You know, I've got some practices where their PCN passes a lot of this money, a lot of the IF money, a lot of the capacity and access money to the practices, which obviously helps with their profits, their income. But then I have been to some practices where they're really struggling because actually the PCN kind of retains all of the money. They don't get involved with the access, they don't get involved, you know, and so they have very small amount of, you know, I've got a couple of practices where they literally just get a bit of PCN participation and a bit of care home money and they get nothing else and it's all retained within the PCN. So that has a real impact, I think, on individual practices' profits as well.
And those listening, you'll know what type of, I guess we could say, PCN you're within. If you're a practice who, let's say, for example, you're operating under the real classic old school model, which is a lead practice with, I don't know, three or four other practices, maybe even less. One practice manages it, charges a very small management fee because when PCNs first started, they were so small. There was very little that needed to happen. And they've grown and grown and grown. But many of you listening will know that you haven't really changed the way you're working. And those PCNs who are operating in that way, generally, we see most of the monies being distributed at the point it comes in. So the lead practice might receive, I don't know, 20 grand in for a service, and it will just immediately distribute it the next day in the ratios of the list size of all four, three or four practices. So the money's coming in and immediately being paid out. I mean, obviously with some retention for a little bit of wiggle room for other costs, but ultimately most of it being distributed. Whereas, as Jenny said, generally those PCNs who are, of course, the ones who are incorporated, because many of those are separate legal entities now, or ones that are operating through federations or networks or confederations, the funding tends to go into the separate entity and doesn't come back out as quickly. Now, of course, there are reasons for that, but ultimately that PCN money is practice money being held by the PCN on trust. And without it, and this goes back to the cash flow issue, without it, this is your money that you really need to be able to support your general practice. And so if you are listening thinking, yes, we're the latter, we don't tend to get much back, it might be worth, you know, getting together as a PCN and having a conversation saying, look, how can we work together to flow the money faster back out to general practice? Because you need it. You really need it.
Yeah, yeah. Katie, let's talk about practices and core funding changes. We obviously had last year, the global sum initially went up by £2.45 per weighted patient. We then had the announcements that staff need to get a 6% pay rise and you were going to be funded. And of course, you weren't funded. You got about another couple of pounds. What are the announcements so far about, you know, about GP practices? Because that's what they're going to want to know. You know, how much is my global sum going to be going up by?
Well, disappointingly, nowhere near as much as you, I, general practice would have liked. So the headline figure is that 259 million is going to be increased into the core funding, which ultimately equates down to about 1.9%. If you do those numbers on a calculator, it comes out as just under £2 per patient, per weighted patient. That's how you're paid in general practice.
And at the moment, they haven't confirmed. So the current global sum amount per weighted patient is £104.73, but they haven't actually yet announced. We seem to get these announcements and then the actual pound per patient gets announced sort of a couple of weeks later, doesn't it?
Hopefully it will be as much as £2 per patient, but Jenny is right. It could potentially be slightly lower. Because these are speculative at present. They're saying we're aiming for 2%, aiming for 1.9%. The BMA have already responded to this and have mentioned that they believe that the figure that they needed to see an increase by would have been an 8.7% uplift, which would be the equivalent of around £9 per patient. So there is a massive difference between £2 a patient and £9 per patient.
And I'm already, Katie, I think there is so much pressure on general practice. You know, we've had, you know, minimum wage rises. So, you know, practices will be so aware that minimum wage from April 24 is going up from £10.42 to £11.44. So that's a 9.7% pay rise on top of a 9% last year. Now, I've been talking to practices because they're worried about their staff. You know, they want to retain staff. They want to keep the pay. You know, some of my staff say, well, with minimum wage going up, there needs to still be a differential between those reception staff on minimum wage and, you know, the next lot of staff. So, of course, if you're putting minimum wage up by 9% and you want to keep that differential, you're then putting the rest of the staff up and you're not being funded. You know, if it's going to be as much as £2 per patient, I mean, £2 per patient, it's not going to bring a huge amount in to cover those staff pay rises. So I know, Katie, I've had quite a few practices actually email me since the announcement to say, Jenny, look, this is what we're looking at with our staff. You know, if this is what we're going to get with the global sum, you know, what are our profits going to look like? I had a client email me last week say, Jenny, is everybody's profits looking like they're going to be down? You know, the reality of this is if you're just relying on that core funding, that's not enough. That's not going to be enough to cover the staff. That's not going to be enough to cover all the other costs that have gone up.
No. And as much as the R scheme is fantastic, so obviously practices can tap into our staff, it isn't, you know, on paper, wonderful. It's effectively a, I don't know, a free resource for the practice. But it isn't as straightforward as that, because those staff members who are operating at the practice, they take up practice admin staff time, practice doctor time, I mean, patient time, of course, but in a different way. There is an element that has not been factored in financially, but that does eat into practice profits just by having those individuals there. And often, you know, practices will need to allow rooms and space. And if that is the case for the R staff, then they can't use those rooms for any other service that could potentially generate income. Yes. So these are all elements of, you know, all these headline figures. But when you actually drill down into it, there are some positives, but there are unfortunately some negatives that you can't necessarily see. And that's what's making it very difficult in general practice at this moment.
Yeah. And I was talking to a practice actually last week, because we were just chatting through about their staff pay rise, and they said, well, what they're trying to do now is if somebody leaves, really think about, do we need to replace them? Can we change other people's roles? I know some practices have benefited where they've moved some of their admin team into care coordinator roles. So some of that salary's been funded. But then when I talk to other practices and I say this, and I know that I think it's a little bit, well, you can't do that because additional roles have to be additional. But actually it's trying to, I suppose, think a bit clever with the staff, because you're not being funded to give all of these uplifts.
No. And what historically a practice was able to afford in staffing the practice, it's just been too squeezed. It, you know, we're in a cost of living crisis, and so pay ultimately has had to go up. But the funding, as we've just mentioned, this potential 1.9% increase, it's nowhere near enough to be able to pass it on. So of course, for those of you listening who know, well, we can't see our staff not get pay rises, or we can't see our staff unable to be given the increases they need, the hit comes out of you, you know, the partners, or, you know, the head GP's pockets. It's the only place it can come. There isn't anything else one can really do.
Yeah. Katie, what were sort of some of the other things that came out of the contract changes that got announced?
Yeah, so I mean, we've sort of touched mostly upon it, but really, again, it came out about staffing and pay rises, that there was going to be a lot more growth within roles at PCN level. Again, that gets passed back to practices. The one thing to take away, and we did just talk about it, is that because the practices are now outside of the five-year contract that Jen mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, there's no set fixed increases now, and that GP practices are supposed to follow the DDRB recommended guidelines. And so, of course, this has caused some controversies in recent years. We've done a few podcasts on it because DDRB recommendations are obviously usually very high, higher than practices have, again, been able to afford. We don't have the DDRB recommendations for the year yet. Summertime, they usually are.
Yeah, it was, because I remember the announcements were like July. Yeah, it was definitely last summer when they said all staff should get 6%. And then we didn't know, of course, what the funding was going to be until the October. Yeah. And practices didn't get some of that funding until November.
Exactly. So at the moment, the headlines in this letter state that they are working towards a 2% pay increase. Again, that implies across the board, excluding minimum wage, because obviously minimum wage is a set increase, as Jenny said. But yeah, so that's sort of the indication that we're looking at 2% pay rises. Many of you who are listening will have already given pay rises every single year, sometimes above the recommendations. But this year it is implied that the pay rise is going to be around the 2% recommendation. And then really the final thing that came out of it, the final focus of the letter, was all about patient access and the use of your telephone or your telephony systems. So we know that a year, two, 3 years ago, over the last few years, PCNs received large amounts of money, funding to pass on to practices to move yourself to cloud-based telephone systems. And by doing this, well, one, for practices, the positive is it's reduced the cost. But two, it just means that the data for those telephones is stored centrally. And it means that practices are able to pull off relevant data according to how many patients call, how many calls are abandoned, how many of those calls transfer into appointments, et cetera, et cetera. And I believe that there's going to be some kind of exercise taken out in the next year or two where you are going to need to pass on the data that's collated from your telephones for the ICBs or NHS England to be able to work out what's going on with your patient access. This is off the back of, I think, a little bit of bad press about practices and appointments. So, you know, we've all read the Mail and the Sun, and they're always, you know, banging on about how you can't get a GP appointment for love nor money. And yes, I think there has been some data to show that face-to-face appointments have gone down. But that isn't necessarily because the face-to-face appointments aren't available. It's that there's been a shift into telephone and online consultations. And Jen, you know, we're two, I was going to say young, working women. I know for me, it might suit me to have an online call with my doctor or a consultation online. If I know it's something that isn't essential, of course, there are some things that face-to-face appointments you're always going to need to have. But actually, there has been a change. And I think that this isn't necessarily a negative. When I read it, it looks like, oh, goodness, is this going to make a negative spin on general practice? But actually, I think it can be seen as a positive.
Yeah. No, Katie, it reminded me of when I have arguments with my friends when they start moaning about GPs and I get really defensive. And I'm like, it's not that they're not seeing it. They are. The demand is so huge. We have less GPs in general practice. So if you've got more demand and less GPs, you've got to find other ways of trying to still provide that service to patients. And, you know, those patients that turn up on your door every week that don't really need to see the doctor, well, a quick telephone call might just be the way to, you know, save time and be more efficient.
And also managing who they see. It's all very well, I call up and say, I'd like to see my doctor. But if the receptionist asks me my issues and realizes, oh, she can see a nurse or a physician associate or somebody else,
then
that, of course, is going to manage your time. So I saw it as a, although it read as a negative, I think ultimately it will be a positive.
Yeah, I think there was some, I don't know off the top of my head, there was some numbers about how many more appointments GPs are dealing with year on year.
I think it was 9%. I think it was appointments were up 9%, something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking 9% and I was like, is that right? Yeah. Mm. Maybe just sort of a couple of final things to mention. So this wasn't part of the contract announcement, Katie, but obviously we've got the superannuation that the tier rates have changed again. So I think a little bit more good news. Come on, let's end on a positive. So superann, you know, the employee tier rate is dependent on what your pensionable profit is. The top tier rate, which 2 years ago or so was 14.5%, it came down to 13.5% in October 22, and it's coming down again to 12.5%. So if you are a GP and your average pensionable profit is 120,000, then the drop from 13.5% to 12.5% will save you about £1,200 a year. So that is a little bit of positive, but that's obviously not in the contract detail. That's obviously just to do with your pensions.
For those of you who were historically on the higher level, because actually the top tier now comes in at just under 63,000, whereas it used to be, what, 111, around 111,000. So pretty much everyone listening, most of you will be automatically on the top tier. You will automatically be a 12.5%. That's for, you know, salaried GPs doing more than 6 sessions and GP partners, really anyone doing more than probably 4 sessions.
Yes.
Or even 5 sessions will be over the 63,000. But it just means that your pension will grow in the same way, but you won't be physically contributing as much. I think, Jen, you worked out on 120,000, it's about a saving from the drop from 14.
Pounds. Oh, yeah. From 14.5% to 12.5%, about 2,400.
Exactly. Yeah. So still the positive growth in your pension, but you physically won't contribute as much. Again, harking back to the beginning, all aiding with cash flow, less money going out of your practice over to the pensions agency. So your superannuation contribution payments for partners specifically will come down, or should come down, because the tier rate has reduced.
Katie, just one final thought, and I don't know whether it's worth us just talking about the recent contract variation notice that we've had some of our clients email us about.
Yeah, I mean, we've had handfuls of clients, you know, often we have this with our very diligent clients who like to send us every letter that they receive. It's very useful, by the way, for those of you who do. So we're aware that different areas of the UK have received contract variation notices. So if you're listening and you haven't got a clue what we're talking about, it's on its way. But if you are listening,
it was a London, wasn't it?
This one's been London, but there have been other areas that have received it. Yeah, so there have been. So if you haven't yet received a contract notice variation, you will. Essentially, what it's saying is they want you to re-sign your contract, and it specifically states that this is to re-sign your 22-23 contract, which is, again, I guess from an accounting perspective, strange. Why would you sign something from effectively as of next week, next month, 2 years ago? But that's specifically what it states. Most of the contract change variations are, you know, wording, narrative around, you know, admin changes. Some of the wording is changed about access and telephones and patient access. But the one that we're concerned with, and the reason we're mentioning this, is because the declaration of earnings has been formalized in there, again, with the job title, place of work, name and earnings. And again, I think it's 163,000 for the coming year. 163, 165. It's around that level. Started at 150, but it's gone up. The implication being, if you sign this new contract variation deed, you are effectively signing to say that you will be correctly declaring your pensionable earnings. And therefore, if you don't declare them, you will officially, in inverted commas, be in breach of your contract if you don't declare. Again, we've done multiple podcasts on this. We did it a while ago and then we re-released it a couple of months ago. We still stand by that. We don't believe there to necessarily be a enforceable breach of contract by not doing this. This isn't necessarily from our mouths because we're not lawyers, but the conversations that we have had with other medical specialists and medical specialist lawyers is that to be in breach of your contract, you have to be unable to provide, you know, satisfactory services to your patients. Well, by not declaring your pensionable earnings, that doesn't impact your patients in any way. In fact, the opposite, we think it really can impact your safety. There will be some GPs who think, you know what, I'm a GP, I'm hardworking, I don't mind somebody knowing I earn £167,000. But there will be others of you listening who know that you, well, one, may not be comfortable with that, and two, will be significantly above that figure and do not want your name and your place of work published in a national publication. So it's just something to be aware of. Nothing has actually changed. It's just that it's formally in this contract variation. And so by signing it, you are authorizing Yeah. You know, that you've acknowledged it, that's just to be aware of.
And I think it's just a case of that some ICBs never got those variations sent out, and so they're doing it. I was with a practice last week and they said, oh no, we had a variation ages ago and it's all been signed. So just to confirm, just the publication of earnings, you are right, for 23-24, that's due by April 25, it's 163,000. The threshold for 22-23, which is due by the end of April, is 159,000.
And if you are listening and you do want to know what your pensionable earnings are, they can be found on your SuperAnn certificate. Of course, those of you who aren't in the pension scheme but are still working, this technically does still apply to you, but you won't have anywhere to find out what your earnings are. So you will obviously need to contact us or your own accountant to give you some information about whether we believe or they believe that you are actually over the thresholds. But your accountant or us, we won't actually have a figure for you because we don't need to calculate it, as we haven't done a SuperAnn certificate. So it's a bit of a tricky one. You know, our argument is, well, if you don't have a SuperAnn certificate prepared, how on earth do you know what your pensionable earnings are? Because you don't. It's not just the figure in your accounts. There's multiple adjustments made to these figures. So yes, it's not a straightforward transaction, unfortunately.
No. Thank you, Katie. That's been really useful. And I hope everyone listening has found that useful. Might not have been the news that we were hoping for, but I think just practices just need to be aware of, you know, more what income is going to be coming in. And then when you're thinking about certainly staff pay rises and staff costs. If you have enjoyed listening to this episode, please like and subscribe, and also tell your colleagues. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
You have been listening to RBP's Accountancy on Prescription podcast. For any updates, please visit www.rbp.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at RBPCA. The contents of this podcast is for general guidance and informational purposes only and does not constitute any form of advice. The information provided by RBP is of a general nature. Appropriate and tailored advice or independent research should be obtained before making any decisions. RBP does not accept any liability for any loss or damage which is incurred from you acting or not acting as a result of listening to Accountancy on Prescription.